Actually, I thought I was going to title it Working with Emotions rather than just the difficult ones, because as Ajahn Sucitto once said, you can't guarantee happiness, but you can guarantee it won't last. So there is an element of suffering in even the most pleasant emotions, because they don't stay if you hold on to it, try to hold on to them. The Buddha very famously said at one time, I teach only one thing, dukkha and the end of dukkha. So dukkha is a Pali word that the Buddhist teaching was written down in. It's a textual language. And it's usually translated as suffering. Sometimes stress, dissatisfaction, inherently unsatisfactory. Actually what he's talking about is something very subtle, something that we wouldn't even think of as suffering or stress. And that's the sense of someone who's outside the experience, someone that this is all happening to. And I tried to touch on that a little bit last week in my talk about no subject, no object, no separation. So I'm going to be a little more grounded tonight, come down from the summit. Often when we think of suffering, we think in terms of physical pain and unpleasant emotions. And it's just interesting just to sit up here and wait for the announcement and to notice all the facial expressions, the way people are interacting, kind of vacant looks, smiles, kind of just every kind of emotion kind of displayed here. You know, it's not that we shouldn't have emotions, but it's a question of how we relate to them. I mean, there's an intelligence in emotions. So I was thinking about what kind of vocabulary I've built over the years practicing this tradition. Irritability, anger, rage, anxiety, fear. Fear is like a puny word, terror, sadness, despair, loneliness. Sense of being inadequate, confusion, shame. So there are a sense of existential angst. You know, what's this all about? Sense of meaningless. I imagine anybody want to offer some additions to that. I'm sure I've missed quite a few. Depression, thank you. Yeah, that's a big one. Yeah. And I know some people in here really had trips to the dark night of the soul, really difficult stuff. The Buddha first said that to recognize dukkha, to know there's some form of suffering coming on. This is the first noble truth. And you might think we would know that. I'm going to take the risk of repeating Narayan's story one more time. She repeated it when I was early in my practice and gave a recent talk on emotions. This was probably 30 years ago or so. For those who don't know, Narayan's a guiding teacher here. She was teaching out at Insight Meditation Society, and she was giving a talk on dukkha. And she said when she first came to this practice, she was making friends with Larry Rosenberg, who founded the center. And she was separating from a friend in another spiritual tradition. And Larry, in a very compassionate way, said, I'm sorry you're suffering so much. And Narayan said, suffering? I'm not suffering. I just hate her. But it's often a case where we're so caught up in the emotion, we don't even see it that way. We see it in terms of right and wrong, should be, shouldn't be. And it's not just powerful emotions, it's moods. We're often caught up in moods, and we're just in a mood all the time, so it just seems perfectly normal. I think that's one reason why some of these practices that actually cultivate skillful emotions, uplifting emotions, is helpful. I remember I went on a retreat at the Forest Refuge one time and I was doing loving kindness practice, and So there's a whole lot of phrases one can use. The typical first phrase is something like, may I be safe and protected. And actually it means safe and protected not from just external stuff, but from your own internal harm as well. Or may I be at ease, may I be happy. So there's a whole set of phrases like that. And just saying those sometimes when you go through the day, you might notice what's actually there. It just brings your attention. Well, I noticed that when I was at the Forest Refuge doing walking meditation, you're saying these phrases all day long. It's like, oh, there's a mood here. And it's just so normal that you don't even notice it. So after recognizing it, the next thing he said is to stand under it, to understand it. And so often what we do is we try and fix it. We react to it. And so it's kind of asking the question, why do we feel so much? Why are we so unhappy? Why do we get so upset? Not an intellectual question, but to look directly. This is what mindfulness is. It's not so much thinking about things, but actually directly observing what's driving things. So every sane person wants to be happy, loved, seen in a positive light, to live in a harmonious and balanced world. But the reality is the world's not like that, is it? I mean, all you have to do is look in a paper or drive in some traffic where you're some impatient person, or our whole environment is competitive. And so we go out in the world sort of quite reasonably looking for something that's uplifting, and there's disappointment. In some sense, another great Ajahn Sucitto quote, we surf a little and crash a lot. So our reality is one of expectation, need, disappointment, and strategies to deal with that. That's the way most people live. That we go out in the world hoping it's going to be a particular way, to get treated a particular way, and sometimes we do. But then things change, and we're disappointed, and so then we spend our life trying to arrange things so it works. So if you ask yourself what dukkha, suffering, is made up of, it's really something psychologically or physically we don't want, or that we don't have and we do want. It's a good question to ask yourself when you're unhappy. What is it that you're trying to get rid of? And it might be that we have a really unpleasant emotion, and it's understandable we don't want it. But what we usually do is try and fix, respond, find some way out of it, which seems like a perfectly reasonable thing, except it doesn't deal with the underlying stuff that's causing it. So it happens over and over again. And sometimes, we're taught just to open to it in practice. Okay, so a difficult emotion comes up and we say, well, if you just be with it, it's impermanent, And there's this kind of bargaining that takes place. If I stay with it, it will get better or it will go away, and we have some timeline about it. But that's not opening to it. That's trying to manage, trying to cope. So we get a lot of support about stress reduction, a way to manage things, but it just really, it's a short-term fix that doesn't really deal with the underlying stuff. It's locked, really locked in the body. It's locked in our whole conditioned way of perceiving the world. And that's not to deny that you shouldn't do anything to cultivate skillful states. A lot of practice, loving kindness practice, compassion, equanimity, they're really intended to develop, I could call it a healthy sense of self or a healthy set of processes or programs, a healthy way of being. The same is true of meditation. Actually, believe it or not, it's supposed to be pleasant. I mean, it's about developing some skill to create a sense of ease. And that's all intended so that we have enough strength to deal with difficult emotions. And at first, maybe it's just being able to deal with relatively minor stuff until we develop a skill at this. Now, I'm going to say something that's really, nowadays to me, seems so obvious. But when I first heard it, it was so profound. So I really want you to take this in. This influences the whole aspect of practice. Where is the I that doesn't want the emotion, that wants to get rid of things, that wants things to be different? You are not having a mental experience. You're being held within the mind as a mental experience. There's no you outside that can control things. Now, this impacts our whole practice, because if there were someone outside, then you could control it. But really, the sense of identity, the sense of who you are, is, you could call it a program, a part, maybe part feels a little bit better, a part of you, that's in the mind-body complex, to be a little more careful about this, that doesn't want another part to be there. And so it's one part of this mind-body process that's fighting another part of this mind-body process. And it probably goes on and on and on. So, you know, often it expresses itself as a form of aversion. We don't want that experience. But that's a surefire way to keep it going. So the practice is opening to what is there. And there are three qualities that I find kind of useful to think about having that allows us to do that. At some simple level, there's really coming into the body. It's really our ground. It's the place that holds emotions, that we can discharge emotions. And there's at some level, it's just coming into feeling where you're standing, your feet on the floor, or maybe feeling the breathing process. There's a very specific part of the body. And then at another level, there's this quality of just presence. So how do you know you're here? Not thinking about it, but how do you actually know you're here? So this is something to explore. There's this, it's not just, you can feel a sense of touch or something, but this is something that doesn't have a particular location. It's just this felt sense of here-ness. Okay, so that's presence. And then there's this quality of awareness. This is really something crucial the Buddha is pointing towards. There's this quality all humans have, to step back, to be aware, to just see, not be caught up in things. In some sense, you could think of it as a form of love. It's fine with the inner critic who tells you you're inadequate. It's fine with the other part that the inner critic is working on, saying you're not adequate, you know, that doesn't feel adequate. It's just holding it, just allowing it to be there, to allow it to express itself, to allow it to rise, abide, and pass away. That's what we need to let these emotions do. And this can be really take some time, a lot of time. Believe me, I've been through a lot of it. And this quality of awareness also has a quality of tenderness to it, a quality of empathy. of caring for. So a lot of times mindfulness is described as kind of mirror-like knowing, but I think that's a little bit too cold. It really senses, it really brings this quality of caring to what's going on. So we want to kind of learn to come into this quality of being in the body, particularly this whole holistic sense of the body, of this quality of awareness, of stepping back and being able to see things, of bringing a quality of tenderness to things. So we can open to the experience and investigate it. So sometimes if you're really in a powerful emotion, it's helpful to do something like, say, budo, which means to be awakened, maybe just bring in bu on the in-breath and do on the out-breath, or doing some loving-kindness practice, compassion. Actually, to see difficult emotions, not in terms of I shouldn't be having this, or telling a story about what this person did or what this person should have done or things like that, but see things in terms of suffering and its end. And then we can bring compassion. How can we care for this pain? Or how can we care for this sorrow? Which is really having to do with any particular emotion. And some framework for actually seeing what we are. Rather than seeing ourselves as some solid identity, see ourselves as processes. And one nice way to break down the processes are this body part, which I've already mentioned, which, you know, all these processes have intelligence. The body knows when to ramp up things when you're furious, so you act, you know, adrenaline can get fed through. It knows when to breathe fast or slow. And it is this place where we can come to and the emotions get expressed and can be discharged. So it's so important in practice to start being more in the body, because the mind, there's another part that makes us up, this conceptual piece, the ability to think, to abstract, to project, that doesn't have any ground, and it's always spinning. Usually it finds trouble somewhere. And then there's a heart piece, the affected piece. It includes emotions, but it's more than that. It's qualities like determination, confidence, perseverance. But it's what gets us here. This doesn't feel right. It was what gets us to practice. So to see ourselves as these processes, and to realize that, you know, we've got a lot of conditioned thoughts about who we should be, what we should accomplish, we should be productive, about what might happen to us. And the heart piece doesn't know the difference between reality and the thoughts concepts. So actually just seeing some thoughts aren't skillful is helpful. Another part, and this is part of right view, the first factor in the Eightfold Path, is to see things in terms of causes and effect. In some sense, what we are is all a result of conditions. One sperm, one out, got to the ovum, and there we are in somebody's... anyway, I won't go into this. And then we get born, right? You know? And we didn't get to choose our parents, we didn't get to choose our genes, and we're born in a society with a certain structure, and we get formed that way. And that's true of everyone. And it's not that you don't have any choice. In Buddhism, there's kind of like a little wiggle room every moment. You know, someone does something that you really react to, and we can pause, we can learn to pause. These intelligent processes can learn to pause and ask, you know, what's wise here? What leads to the end of suffering rather than being reactive? But it's also helpful in terms of looking at ourselves and others, that maybe there's guilt because I've had a lot of questions from someone in a group I teach about someone who has a tremendous amount of guilt because of something they didn't do to help someone. But, you know, that person did what they could do at that moment. And just the parents we got could do what they could do because of causes and conditions. So it's not like giving up any sense of being able to respond, but also to respect that, you know, we are conditioned. And we start needing to understand those conditionings. And that's true about how we meet other people as well. People who have done unskillful things, people who are really annoying. But, you know, they're just like us. They're little bozos on a bus who are trying to do the best they can. Okay. So when we have a difficult emotion, we do want to know what's happening. And some people actually like to label things. And that's a way to kind of develop some stepping back a little bit, like anxiety's happening, fear's happening, irritability, anger, etc. But more importantly, it's how we relate to our experience. To just open to them, to see them as in terms of suffering, the end of suffering. We want to see whether we're trying to push them away, which is some form of aversion, fixing, coping. And, you know, if we can't be with it, then we can be with the aversion. And if you can't be with the aversion, you can be with not being able to be with the aversion, okay? There's always a way to open up. It's not that we're trying to get even rid of aversion. We just see, aversion's happening now. Or are we trying to hold on to something, clinging to some emotion or some idea we have? Sometimes, you know, that emotions are just overwhelming. And so we want to ask, you know, maybe to rouse some interest, some way to investigate this. So we might ask ourselves, how do we know fear or boredom or despair or anxiety is happening? And we might observe that there are thoughts occurring. So can we just then observe the thoughts? We don't need to stop them, but we also don't feed them. So this quality of awareness of stepping back and seeing that there are thoughts occurring. You know, their thoughts are like little programs and views about how we learn to see the world. And we don't have to believe them. In fact, it's probably generally a good idea not to in most cases. And sometimes it's good to disentangle them. Sometimes we're telling some story about what might happen, and it's just like we're actually talking about something, what will happen to me, what could happen to me, and how things will be if it does happen to me. It's pure speculation. It's a fabricated future. So simply to see that. But often thinking is a defense. We go up in the head and we tell some story because we don't want to feel what's going on. So once we see that thoughts are occurring, see if we can really come directly to the experience. How do we know physically that there's fear or anxiety or despair or heavy? Maybe there's a heaviness in the body. Maybe we're not breathing. And sometimes that's really helpful to see that. I mean, I discovered a long time ago the way I often responded was I didn't get all upset. I just stopped breathing, you know. I mean, I'd rather breathe some or I wouldn't be up here talking to you. But I really, once you see that, then maybe you can start opening up. It's a way of not being able to feel things. So I want a little quote from Shunryu Suzuki, who wrote Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, a very deep book. And he said, when you observe delusion as, this is just a delusion, you have your true peaceful, calm mind. When you start to cope with it, you will be involved with the emotion. So you can substitute in your emotion of choice. When you have fear, if you just say, this is just fear, then you have a true, calm, peaceful mind. When you start coping with it, trying to get rid of the fear, then you're lost in it. So this is our practice, to open to what's there. And this quality of awareness, this quality of presence, of tenderness, can hold this. And it's a skill. I mean, you might, people say, well, come to the breath. And you think, this puny little thing? Yeah, that's all they're giving me in this place? So it takes some practice. But I remember when I was younger and there was a lot more strong emotions, certainly with my wife and I, and I'd be sitting with adrenaline flowing through me. But it was a place of refuge to come to be able to sit, just to be in the body and not say a whole bunch of things that are just going to lead to more trouble down the road. And one thing to notice is sometimes just how the mind contracts around things. That someone you're really in a relationship and it's been really great, and all of a sudden that person has no quality, what good quality whatsoever. It's just totally gone. And that's why sometimes even actually directing metta or loving kindness to the other person is helpful. Sometimes it's helpful to ask the question, am I afraid of this feeling? I can't be with it. It's too much. But we don't have to be with it forever. All you have to do with it be is right here, right now, this very moment. Can you be with it this very now moment? Sometimes asking the question, can I be with this right now? It just goes away. And we might know that rationally that this is not going to last forever and that we're creating a whole story. But it's not enough to know rationally. We really have to meet it fresh, alive, and sensitive in the very moment now. This is really what mindfulness is. It's dropping these whole concepts and rational stories and things and actually getting in touch with the direct experience and allowing it to do what it needs to do. Sometimes bringing in compassion. Again, to see things in terms of suffering and its end. So using phrases like, may I care for my sorrow, to bring in this quality of tenderness, because it's a part of us. And rather than being at war with it, can we let it be what it needs to do? I remember one time I was at the Forest Refuge, and I had this amazing retreat. I mean, all these teachers just keep going and all this. And then some teacher came up to me and thought I was deluded. It was sort of the end of the retreat, and there was a new shift of teachers came in. And I thought, well, I don't need to get in a struggle with her. I have my last interview with her. I'll be going home. And then she put a note up and asked me if I'd like to talk about it. And I said yes. And as soon as I did that, boy, it just triggered things. I'm going to straighten her out. I mean, it's just, and you know, I'm pretty skilled at this stuff. I came to the body, not working. You know, just the rage is just going, adrenaline's flowing. And I started doing some walking meditation, long walk. It didn't help. And then there's a realization, there's this defender piece of me. It's been around for a long time because of things that happened to me. And, you know, sometimes even subtle pushes just triggers that. And then I thought, oh, you poor thing. How hard must it be to have to do this all the time? And it wasn't contrived. There was just a real sensitive caring to seeing this as a part of me that served a function. And there was some peace that occurred because of that. Really quite amazing. I've had a number of experiences like that. We're just opening to what's there and caring for it. So realizing that no feeling is final. Everything's impermanent. And we don't often see things are impermanent because we don't have enough stability to stay with them. I mean, think of every emotion you've ever had. Where is it now? So we're often trying to fix it and get rid of it, and we never see that it has a life of its own. It comes, it's there for a while, and it goes. And we can't arrange it to just be good all the time. I've asked this question many times. So how many people always have positive emotions? I haven't gotten a person to raise their hand yet. Want to try again tonight? I don't know. So it's a few more questions. So in terms of this quality of awareness of stepping back, in some sense we want to rouse this wisdom that's there that can hold us all. So there's some questions like, in the moment of really being upset, and you know, we can ask, where is the peace in this moment? Or if we're dissatisfied, where is the contentment in this moment? If there's a heavy mood, we can ask, where is the happiness in this moment? Maybe if we're angry, conflict, where is the love in this moment? This is the way to shift the energy of the moment, to realize there's something that's present, this quality of awareness and presence and empathy that's really fine. It has comfort in the midst of discomfort, peace in the midst of non-peace. And this takes some faith, some practice to see that there is this capability. So in some sense, it's learning not to identify as these emotions as who we are, or this body as who we are. I think of Sam over here talking about, you know, asking, you know, a surgeon tells him he's having a heart attack, and he says, who's having a heart attack? Right? So you can ask yourself, who's having this emotion? So one acronym so in the Buddha's framework, you're seeing, okay, you see that there's some form of suffering, that's recognizing it, then standing under it, okay, which you could say allowing it. Sometimes people use the word acceptance, but a lot of people don't like that because it sounds too much by resignation, but it's just really opening to it now so that we can have some discernment, some understanding to it, which is the third part, to investigate, to see what's causing this. And it's not necessarily, it could be thinking about it, but often it's really directly experiencing what's going on and allowing it to do what it needs to do. And the third piece is not identifying it with it as you. Who is having this? So there's a nice little acronym, RAIN. You can just Google RAIN and Buddhism and you'll probably get some nice little articles about it. Recognize, allow, investigate, and not identify with. So I want to end by reading three little pieces. There's a story about a woman, Padakara, who had some just terrible experiences. Her two sons were killed and her husband killed within a very short time period, within a week or so. And the story is that she's walking around with her clothes half falling off. She's crazed telling these stories. And she comes to the Buddha. And he tells her to regain her presence of mind. This is this awareness, just to directly see what's going on. Drop the story. So this is a quote from, I can't think of his name now. Come to me. I'll read it, and then maybe I'll look his name will come up to me. He teaches at Berry Center for Buddhist Studies. Buddha's advice to Padakara to regain her presence of mind seems to cut to the core in terms of our own practice. So regaining your presence of mind is our practice, to be mindful, to see directly. Seeing grief as grief, sorrow as sorrow, joy as joy, and so on. But also seeing that in each seeing, that includes a seeing that's free from grief, from sorrow, from joy. In other words, each moment of grief, sorrow, joy, etc. is grief / freedom from grief, sorrow / freedom from sorrow, joy / freedom from joy. I hesitate to use the word transcendence because it's not a helpful word in the English language. But the idea is that the emotion of each moment contains its own transcendence of that emotion. And he asks, does that make sense? Is there something with every emotion, everything that's going on, that's at peace in the midst of it all? And the next thing I want to read is, this woman is not a Buddhist, but she certainly had a trip in the dark night of the soul and wrote a poem called Beyond Brokenness, for Shani Ray. And this is a little excerpt from it. It is not a manner of banishing grief, but of turning towards it with tenderness, opening to whatever it will reveal, by calling it to our arms where it can change. So this is opening to it, this awareness, this tenderness to bring it there so it can change, release itself. We discover a deeper aspect. So by calling it to our arms where it can change, we discover a deeper aspect of joy. Joy that is not the removal of grief, but the capacity to meet whatever arises moment to moment with compassion. Can we trust our brokenness enough to look and feel deeply into its sentient essence? Okay. And the last one, I'm going to read is from Pema Chodron, who I think had her 79th birthday a few days ago. Is that the right year? So Pema Chodron, for those who don't know her, was practiced in Tibetan tradition. And she's talking about, she's at this monastery, and there's a woman who just always mistreats her, so cold to her, and she swears she's going to sit with it. And she said, as I sat, I began to have this quality of experiencing what I was going through with this woman. I had a body memory of being a very little child, but it wasn't like I was remembering a traumatic experience or anything. I just realized at a cellular level that my entire ego structure, my entire personality was designed never to go to this particular feeling. And that's the case with so much of us. We're so defended. Our whole personality structure is around not having to feel something that's underneath. I began to experience a deep feeling of inadequacy, like I wasn't okay. I realized that what I was experiencing was the complete death of the ego. Now, I really suspect that Pema didn't have a complete death of the ego, but it dies in pieces. It dies in moments. And there's a shift in consciousness. There's something that breaks through dukkha. Just the pressure of being with it that breaks through. And there's something that's at ease, that's compassionate, that doesn't have opinions. And that's what this practice is about. So I'm going to stop there and open up to questions. Anything to do with suffering, stress, dissatisfaction, happiness, emotions, all relevant. Yeah.
Okay. Can everyone hear me? Okay. So the emotion that I feel like I struggle with the most, that I'm most sloppy with, is anger. That's the one where it's like, it almost seems like this primal thing, adrenaline's coming, and it's really, really hard to manage. But sometimes I wonder, okay, is doing some of these practices, is that sort of suppressing it and sort of pushing it away? And is it productive to feel it and to be with it? And is it telling me something that I need to know about a relationship or a situation? So I get kind of lost there.
So is this like always anger, or anger is triggered by particular experiences?
So maybe there's like, I think there are some probably common themes, but yeah. I know, I don't want to go into like all my stories. But I mean, in relationships, like with my husband, yeah. I mean, it just seems like that's a place where some really raw emotion gets unleashed sometimes.
And
we're not yellers, we're not like anything like that. But we don't fight really. But sometimes it's like you can feel the tension in the room, and I wonder, like, do I need to stay with this? And is this telling me something about the relationship that I need to adjust, or do I need to look at myself and think about, like, who's, is this fear? Is this defense? Is this something very old?
So how do you feel like your practice makes you suppress it?
I don't know if I do feel like that. I'm just asking.
Oh, okay.
Like, if, sometimes I feel like it's productive to express anger and to be with it and to say the things that piss you off and to really, but then also sometimes I feel like that can get you spinning out of control and it can lead to more suffering.
Right.
And I guess that's what I struggle with now, is sort of knowing when to stay with it and look at it and, you know, kind of use it, and when to say, hey, you know, this is kind of, this is toxic.
Well, I mean, you know, it's not that we shouldn't have emotions. I mean, emotions motivate us to do things. I mean, it's interesting in some of the commentary on Disney's new movie, Inside Out, which is a story of a little girl who has to move, I don't remember which direction, from Minnesota to Los Angeles or Los Angeles to Minnesota. But, you know, there are these five characters who are supposed to be her emotions. And there was an interview with the person who was acting as advisor to it. And he talked about emotions are, they inform the rational mind in a way. So anger is actually sometimes a really legitimate motivator when action needs to be taken place. I think what I find useful, I mean, I've certainly had my moments here and there, is just to sit with it and ask myself what's helpful. And, you know, not so much as sort of seeing you have a particular view of things, and rather than taking on, you know, like, you should be like this or, you know, like that, to actually explore maybe, like, what's going to lead to an end of suffering here. And end of suffering may be to try and get him to change his behavior, it might be. But then to, you know, bring a quality empathy to him and see what the views are that are driving that. And see if you can come to a place of calm, to see if you can both actually talk about it. So the anger is kind of triggering a motivation to deal with something that needs to be dealt with. And at the same time, you don't want to be reactive to it. So you want to be with it enough to be responsive. And there are also, you know, aside from that, I mean, even when one might have a really perfectly reasonable way to reason to respond that way, sometimes we have conditioning that makes us really overreact. I mean, I know I've it's really diminished over time, but it used to be if somebody just was a little off, the reaction was like, I mean, it's not like even a conceptual, it's like a whole body response to it, you know. So then I think, in addition to dealing with the particular situation, is sometimes it's just allowing it to be there. You might see what's underneath it, which is probably a lot of hurt. I mean, usually there's underneath hard emotions is something soft, you know, like my inner critic's defending some really hurt piece.
Yeah, this is the opposite end. It speaks to your opening quote from Ajahn Suchito about, we don't know about happiness, but we do know that it's impermanent. I've had a life, probably for the last 16 years, that I've been buffeted by events that just kind of knock me to the floor. And I've had a strong practice, for the past 3 years. And then since November, I moved here from California, and I've been unsettled in a state of groundlessness since then, and suffering quite a bit. And right now, I'm confronted with an unsettling moment where I don't know where I'm going to be living or how I'm going to be living. And yet, I'm equanimous and have been for a couple weeks. Meanwhile, underneath me, there's this cauldron of, you know, uncertainty. And so now I've kind of feel like the unsettlingness of equanimity. It's like I keep thinking, how long is this going to last? I'm able to ride this wave, and there's sharks all around me. And how? Why? Question, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one is, you know, there's sort of questions, is it really equanimity, or are you kind of up in the head, not disconnected? And I'm not saying you are, but it is a question to explore. Are you just disconnected from the underlying emotions that are there? So that's just something to explore in your body. I'm not saying that's the case. Okay.
Right. Well, that is the question. I mean, I actually think sometimes that I'm getting dumber and dumber because things aren't affecting me. And it feels healthy to me. It feels like, yeah, it is. It's like Ajahn Chah says, it's uncertain. Life, everything is uncertain. And I think there's a Paul Simon song about this, about how being uncomfortable with everything being okay.
Yeah, you know? Well, I mean, Alan Watts wrote a book, The Freedom of Insecurity.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if it's authentic, that's fine. And I think it's just, the way to check is to notice how things feel in your body. Notice maybe if there's some place to tighten, are you breathing okay or something like that. And then your second question, will the equanimity last? Just be willing to bow to not having equanimity. That if it's gone, then okay, then I'll be with not being equanimous. I mean, I went through this period where my son was going through something really terrible, and I was so present. But I was sitting around hospitals, like, you know, I got sick, I wasn't getting any sleep, and then I felt like I couldn't cope. And a very wise Dharma friend said, okay, then bow to not coping. Okay. Yeah. Am I back here somewhere?
I'd like to continue. Can you hear me all right? I'd like to continue this question that's about equanimity because... the longer that that the practice has been going on with me, the more I'm struggling with something. And well, let me give you an example. I'm the person that had the heart attack 2 months ago, and I was in this investigative class, and so I didn't know it was going to happen, but I just asked myself, who is it that's having the heart attack? And that was a fruit of practice. That came out of practice. But since that time, I know that if I try to get that freedom back, it's going to create more suffering. I know that. And because I've come to a lot of talks here and a lot of retreats, there are other views I know, other wise views I know about don't cling to anything as me or mine, don't identify, don't make things into anything solid. But here's where I struggle. And Narayan said this to me last week. The emotional maturity, the level of emotional maturity is immature. It's not caught up with the wise view. The wise views are up here. The emotional maturity is down here. And it's kind of what other people were saying, but it's not just limited to one thing. It's omnipresent. It's just there. And I can bow to it. I can accept or try to accept it. But the reality is, still coming back, that I still have this suffering, and it's because the emotional maturity is not at the same level as what... I mean, I know about dwelling on problems or not dwelling. I know those things, but the emotional maturity doesn't.
Right.
And it's an ongoing struggle for me with that situation.
So when the emotional maturity doesn't know, what's happening?
When the emotional...
Well, you know, you know all these things, and then you say, okay, so... At a conceptual level, you understand all this, you know, it's not you having a heart attack, it's not your emotions. But where's the emotional immaturity, how's it manifesting? How do you know you have it?
I know I have it because my frustration tolerance drops way down.
Yeah.
That's one sign. Like right. Something that would just irritate me a little bit really gets me angry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or there are other things. Maybe I feel much more depressed. I feel much more sad. I feel much more anxious. I feel much more despair. And I know those are all pointing to this emotional immaturity.
So when you say you're feeling more, are you saying more than when?
Well, it could be an event like a heart attack. It could be I lost my home a few years ago.
So it's more than before these events occurred. Is that what you mean? Or
it's, what do you mean it's more?
Well, you say you have more frustration, more irritation. I'm just trying to think about when you say more relative to what?
I think right now with the way things are happening now, it's, I think since I had this diagnosis of a heart condition.
Yeah. Well, I think part of it might well be physical, right? I mean, we're just what we are. We're a result of causes and conditions, and the physical affects your ability to open to things. And, you know, there's no easy way out of that. It's like, okay, it is really bowing to. Can you do it? See where you don't want to be with it. And not see intellectually, not conceptually, but see actually if you can feel it. How do you know? So you have irritation, for example, okay? So irritation is present, period. You know that's there, right? So are you adding something onto that, or are you just being irritated?
I think I'm doing both, yeah.
Okay, if you're adding something onto it, then focus on what you're adding onto it, that you shouldn't be irritated. Because you have some idea, it seems like, just a guess, but it seems like you have some idea, I really have this wisdom up here, right? And yet, there's this kind of like, so why am I still having emotions? But it doesn't work that way. You know, I remember Narayan and Michael's teacher, Sheng Yen, said in emptiness, laughing, crying. So he knows that these emotions don't belong to anyone, but that doesn't mean he doesn't have them.
Okay, so keeping that in mind, what distinguishes between emotional maturity and emotional immaturity?
Well, you can ask Narayan next time and you can tell me. I mean, I think what happens is that over time, what's conceptual, this ability to step back moves into something that is more of dispassion, a really embodied understanding of what you have in your head. So that you know really in an embodied way that this is just nature playing itself out. You're not fighting with it. It comes and goes. It's impersonal. You really, truly, in an embodied sense, don't see that as you. I mean, it was interesting. I was up here, and I was just like watching these, you know, before the talk, and I was kind of watching these emotions come, like, you know, at one moment they're sort of like, what am I doing up here, you know? I mean, I suppose I could talk about it. And it wasn't like, you know, life-threatening, but it was sort of like that kind of thing going on. And then there was another kind of, you know, another emotion came. But there was something that's just like, it's like almost like watching, just watching it move. It's okay. It's okay. There's a little bit of like, you know, look at all these faces out here, and you know, are they gonna, you know, what do they expect? I don't know if that makes any sense, but it really,
no, it is. It's like you're. I hear you saying is it's almost a deeper form of acceptance.
Yeah, it's embodied. It's not heady anymore. I remember once I was out at the forest refuge, and I had something happen, and I just immediately saw the thought was empty. You know, I mean, it wasn't like I said it, you know, it was like I really knew in a body way. And I told this to Joseph Goldstein, who was one of the teachers out there. And Joseph said, okay, if you see it's empty, don't worry about it. And then another teacher said, well, you might want to go down and look. So it's tricky. You kind of need to see, really, is there something down here that I'm trying to get rid of by saying it's not me? You know, that's spiritual bypass, right? It's not me. It's all empty and personal. We can't do that either. Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Sam. And let me know what the definition you get for emotional maturity.
I will definitely investigate this.
Okay.
Okay, maybe changing gears a little bit. Question for you about sort of pain, I guess. Something I've been thinking about recently is, how would you view this, I guess? I'm realizing sometimes that there are things in my life where I am discovering a way that I want to live or a choice that I want to make that doesn't necessarily align with my highest ideals for how maybe I should live or how I could be. And kind of in recognizing that, yeah, deep down, I actually don't want to live up to a particular ideal that I think is the best way to live. And so I feel like there's a sense of difficult emotion or pain with that, because you feel like you either can live up to your ideal and kind of eliminate what you feel like you want to do with your life, or you can sort of live your life and deal with the pain of not living up to your highest ideal. I was curious how you'd think about that, or maybe there's a better way to think about it.
No, I'm not sure what to say about this, so let's explore a bit. I mean, where is the ideal coming from?
I guess handed to you by, I guess partially from society, partially from family.
Yeah.
External sources, but also sort of an internal belief that it could be a good ideal. I guess there's a mix of all sorts of things.
Okay. I mean, I think we can do this in practice. You know, we come to practice and we think we should be a kind person, a compassionate person. And they are useful pointers. But really, it has to be an expression of the heart, your real affected sense, not something that someone tells you you should be. And so then I think, you know, looking at what you want to do and see what's driving that. You can just open to it, not just, but open to it and see it, what you really want. You know, it's... I'm not sure where to go with this, but let me give you some example of my own personal life. My wife's an activist. I mean, she's out there doing so much, it's unbelievable. I mean, you know, and sometimes I just say, well, at least I'm helping her do it. And, you know, and sometimes I have these thoughts, like, I mean, I've actually had dialogues with Narayan and other people about, you know, there's this sense of I should be doing more. But the Buddha once said very famously, anything you conceive of, things are other than that. So I've been trying to live without concepts, to just see what moves me. Now, if that movement is trying to get something, to fill up, to move from a sense of lack, then there's some work to do there. Okay. So really to look at, see what's really moving you and how that conflicts with these ideals. But, I mean, it's to take on ideals about we should be a particular way. I don't think it's such a good idea. I remember listening to, you know, in Zen tradition, there's bodhisattva vows. I vow to save all sentient beings. And my wife and I went and listened to a talk by two Zen masters and a lama about how we should all get out there and do things. And when we got in the car and I was trying not to say anything because I didn't want to bias my wife's response to it, but she had the same response I had. They were like making a me who should be a certain way. My wife as an activist, not because she believes she should do it, because it's a natural movement of her heart. And I'm doing what I do because it's a natural movement of my heart. And it is, it's so can you find something that's really enlivening for you, fulfilling? The best person I know of in terms of expressing this is Eckhart Tolle in The New Earth. He talks about three aspects of awakening, and I'm just going to talk about one because we don't have all night, which is sometimes there's just a passion to do something, just a natural energy to do it. And you can know when the ego gets involved, when you start clamping down and get attached to, you know, the outcome, the sense of, you know, I'm doing it, I should be a certain way. Okay. Thanks. Yep.
I've never been able to wrap my head around the end part of RAIN or this question of, you know,
not identifying
who's having a heart attack.
Yeah.
So could you please talk about it a little bit? Because, you know, I've read a lot of texts.
Yeah.
I've heard people talk about it, but I just can't wrap my head around it.
Where are you? Where is the you? No, seriously, what are you? Are you your body? Are you your emotions? Are you your thoughts?
I mean, not entirely. I mean, none of these are entirely applicable.
Right. Are you your patterns of behavior?
I guess everything a little bit.
So these are just some questions that hold, okay? There's a lot of levels at which to look at. One sense of what we think of ourselves, I talked about cause effect as being an important part of right view, is to see that you're nothing, you're not some noun. You know, whatever, what's your name?
Dev.
Dev?
Yeah.
So you're not Dev. You know, you get born into this world and people say, oh, Dev, you know, you should do this, you should be like this, oh, you're so smart, or you shouldn't have done that. And all there's a whole identity created around what you've been told you are. And everyone sort of sees certain ways that they behave, certain emotional qualities that tend to be there all the time, certain thought processes, the way the body looks, and they identify with these processes, these patterns that are playing out. But that's all that are patterns. They're like little programs that are running, intelligent programs. I don't mean to dismiss them as something impersonal. They're all these little parts of you. One part of you wants to do one thing, and another part wants to do another. Does that ever happen? Is the one part of you ever say you should be like this, another part say that, you know, it's talking to another part of you?
Absolutely.
Right. So that's not you. It's just these processes are playing out. It's not. It's not like something. In some sense, it's not anything deep spiritual breakthrough. This is what all neuroscientists would say. Right? There's internal family systems therapy that says, you know, look at these as yourself as a family. And there are all these parts playing out. So it's the ability to kind of step back from this is who I am, which locks things in, and I'll always be there, to saying, oh, there are these thought processes going on, there are emotions going on, there's this body, and I can work with it in a skillful way. So that's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is, well, how does the sense of me occur? And I talked about this some last week. Was there a you there when the bell was heard?
I mean, I would say yes.
You say yes? What happens is that there's a physical sensation or a thought that occurs. And this is actually part of what I talked about last week. Bahia Sutta says, in the heard, there's just the heard, in the seen, there's just the seen, in the cognized, there's just the cognized, and so on with all the other sense experiences. That's this profound teaching. You should practice like this. There is irritation. And there's no one having irritation. There is despair, and there's no one having despair. There's no one outside the experience. That's what I talked about dukkha, being the end of dukkha, is being this, really this profound sense of someone outside the experience. So what happens is that the mind, after the experience, infers that, oh, I heard the bell. And it forms an opinion about it. But that's just the way the neurosystem works. It's an inference. When we're looking, you know, seeing each other, so there's sight photons going in your eyes, they go in the back of your head, and there's an image form, and your neurosystem translates that as, oh, well, he's up there about 30 feet away, an old guy, you know. And I'm in here seeing it. But where's the image? It's in the back of your head. It's all dark in there. And there's no you sitting back seeing it. That's an inference the mind makes up. So, you know, the Buddha never really said, actually, he never really answered the question, is there self or not self? What he said was, what isn't self? Actually, I didn't use the word not self. A lot of people translate as not no self, but Ajahn Tanisaro translates as not self, which I like better. So, you know, the body is not self. The emotions are not self. They're constantly changing. If they were you, why can't you just control them? So, from a practical perspective, in terms of working with emotions, is to see when you're saying, this is me, this is my emotion. Because when you do that, you clamp down on it. So you can ignore whether it's the self or not self. Just be aware, just know that there's something that has the ability to step back and be aware of it and allow it to be there. Okay?
Makes sense. Thank you. Yep.
Back.
Thanks. Thanks for your talk. I was just thinking about the difference between the sort of the absolute that you're talking on and then the sort of practical, pragmatic.
Yeah.
Because sometimes going to the absolute can feel very threatening. I mean, if I first heard the idea like there's no self, that kind of, or I know you're not saying that specifically, but it can be a little unnerving.
Yeah.
And how to be sort of finding a way through that. I was thinking about what this man was saying about, and you were saying about no self, that in that experience of understanding suffering and the end of suffering, that might be the sort of linchpin between the sort of more pragmatic and the absolute experiences, so that if I recognize, oh, that's causing me suffering, I can let that go. And then eventually get to a point where I can realize there's no self experiencing that suffering. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, in some sense, you know, one way I found very helpful, Ajahn Sachito talks about this, and if anybody's interested, you can just Google this. It's Kama and the End of Kama. There's a nice little free book out, Kama, K-A-M-M-A, and the End of Kama, which is about cause and effect. And he talks about, you know, practice in some sense is about developing these healthy processes, or healthy self, if you want to use that language. So doing loving kindness, compassion practice, learning to calm yourself. But no matter how well we do that, no matter how skillful we are, things happen, right? And so, in a sense, this not self is a strategy, a psychological strategy. It's kind of letting go through wisdom, really, through letting things be, seeing that there's something that's at peace in the midst of all this. It's not controlling things, not running the show. It's about not having any particular state. So if you're irritable, okay, be an irritable Buddha. It's like being fine with what's there. We're human, we have emotions, things are difficult, and we simply allow it to be there. It's not ours. It doesn't belong to anyone. And we don't separate from it. So it's not like denying it. It's like being completely it. It's like not struggling, no resistance, not wanting to get rid of, because that's what's there right now. Make sense? Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, maybe one more. Okay, Sam, up here. this way. Traffic director.
So this is, can you hear me?
Yeah, just keep it close.
Okay, this may be simple and I may just not be getting it, but where I'm confused is you talk about it's not you and you're kind of observing it. So you're saying, let's say I have fear. So fear is happening to me.
I am fear. How's that? That's what I remember when I first took Thich Nhat Hanh said, you know, rather than being I am angry, say I am anger. I didn't know what he's talking about. But just be fear.
So I'm watching, so I feel a tension.
Yeah.
And I'm watching this and I'm say fear is happening and then I am fear.
Well, don't say anything, actually. Just be with experience. And just notice that that any resistance to it.
Okay. Because the thing that I'm confused about is you refer to being detached from it and saying and watching it and saying you are it. So is that...
Yeah, well, don't... the truth is, don't say anything. The truth is, move out of the head and go directly into the experience. So the saying is, you know, sometimes saying things is a way to kind of make it, I hate to use this word because it said don't manage things, but it is a way of trying to make it so you can find a way in to open up to it so you can be with the experience but not lost in it.
So not lost in it is a critical thing. So
you don't want to be totally like, you know, just terrorized.
So you're aware, so I am fear and I'm aware that I am fear.
You're aware that there's fear. I think that's the best way to do it. Just see, just notice you're directly observing. So don't even put a name on it. I mean, putting a name on it might be helpful to sort of get you to turn your attention to it. But then, and some people use labeling as a technique. But the problem with labeling, and it's useful because it helps you kind of not be so caught in it. But you really don't. The problem with labeling is it turns it into a noun and it separates you from a direct experience. So it might be helpful to say there's fear rather than I am fear. There is fear. But then see if you can open directly to the experience. How do I know there's fear? The heart's beating fast or whatever.
That's the investigate and rain.
Yeah. It's to see how you know there's fear. And then, but you want to do it in a way that you can be with it rather than lost in it, which means that somehow you might notice how the mind might be contracting around or telling stories around it, or you might just feeling your buttocks on the cushion or something. So you want to be able to open to, but not being, you know, traumatized or overwhelmed by it. And sometimes you need to get away from it.
So the end, so you investigate, and the end is...
not identifying. Don't tell stories, I am afraid. Just be with the direct experience.
I am not afraid, I am fear. Okay.
Well, there is fear, maybe it's better, actually, or, you know. And then drop the label if you can. Just to see if you can open up to it. And then a lot of it after that is finding a way to open up to it. And that might be being aware of the area around you, or... you know, bring your attention to the breathing process. Sometimes if it's really overwhelming, to just walking rhythmically, like someone holding a baby, and you just kind of walk with a walk that makes it manageable.
Well, usually it involves a situation. Investigation does include other people and what's going on your life.
Right. So the situation is kind of looking at, okay, well, you know, there's some outcome that we're afraid of, right? That there's fear of. And to see that that's a projection. That's about something that could happen, might happen, and what it will be like if it does happen. But as far as I know, maybe somebody, very few people die of emotions. So the question is to ask yourself, can I be with it right now? And that's, you know, that's the way John Kabat-Zinn got people to work with chronic pain. Rather than projecting, like, I can't be with this pain, you know, for another 10 minutes, the question is, can you be with the fear right now? Because part of the struggle is, right, that you're afraid it's going to, you know, there's some sort of projection it gets lost in, rather than what's the direct experience now?
Yeah, you have sense you're in a dungeon, and that's the battle.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, just nice to spend the evening with you, and I hope you have all positive emotions all evening long. Probably not, but...
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.